From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. So I'm writing a book about kindness right now, which I'm going to do in my way with a lot of expletives and embarrassing personal stories. And our guest this week fits perfectly into that because he's written a book about kindness. Not a lot of swearing in his, but he knows a lot more than I do. His name is Dzigar Khantrul Rinpoche. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He'll pronounce it correctly for us. Rinpoche just means he's a respected and high-level teacher in the Tibetan tradition. He's also a reincarnate. He's a designated as a third reincarnation of a previous Rinpoche, a great lama from generations past. And we get into an interesting conversation about my skepticism about the whole reincarnation thing. But primarily we talk about why, and this is what I'm talking about in my book, why it is in your interest to not be a jerk, and what kind of meditation we can do to boost our capacity to not be a jerk. All right, so Dzigar's coming up, but first I want to say something, and then I want to take your calls, and then we'll get to the guest. I want to say thank you. A couple of weeks ago, we mentioned that we're doing a survey of podcast listeners to help us do a better job, and hundreds of you took time to answer the questions. Hundreds and hundreds of you. And I am really moved by that fact and extremely grateful. And I just want you all to know that we are combing through the results. Some of it's quite humbling, humbling in that there were some real criticisms in there, but all of it is incredibly useful. This is going to be our Bible as we continue to tweak and hopefully grow this show. So I just want to say a really sincere thank you, and a lot more to come. We're gonna be working on this show for a long time, and the results we got from that survey are going to be extremely helpful. So one of the things we heard in the survey is that people are pretty tired of my caveat that I issue every week before I take the phone calls, the voicemails. So I won't issue it this week. I may do it in the future. So let's just get right to call number one.
Hi, Dan. My name is Kadeem, a PhD student studying applied economics at Harvard, and got really into meditation through you, so that's been awesome. I was curious if you could talk about the internal experience that you have while meditating, and be more specific. In probably the last few months, I'm meditating for maybe 6 months, in the last few months, I've developed this tendency to have sort of euphoric experiences and feeling like the inside of my mind gets really like light and feeling it physically, almost as if I'm kind of high or something like that when I meditate. And the first time it happened, it kind of freaked me out, like what the hell's going on, but I've learned to sort of appreciate it. But I'm just wondering if you can have these sort of physiological experiences in your head and your face and other parts of your body while you're meditating that you feel you otherwise don't have, and if you could talk about what those experiences are like. Thanks.
The answer is yes, it's very common. Usually in my understanding and experience among people who are, at a significant dosage of meditation, but I don't think there's any reason. I think it can happen to people doing even low dose meditation, no question about it. It's very common to have all sorts of interesting experiences, physical sensations that you've never experienced before, negative or positive, psychological and emotional stuff along the lines with you're describing, but the range is vast. This is what happens when you start looking at the mind and training the mind. It doesn't always happen. You can't count it on it happening. And I would suggest you, since you're in Cambridge and you're right near the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, that you go and talk to a really genuinely experienced teacher there about what you're experiencing, because I think it would be very interesting to hear from somebody like that, because there's a lot to say that I'm not really qualified to say. In fact, I talked a moment ago about our survey, and one of the things that I think we may do as a consequence of this survey, because there were many wise suggestions in there, but one of them was that perhaps some of these questions where I'm not qualified to answer, we will get meditation teachers to answer them in briefly. But since it's me here right now, just me here right now, I will say that the one thing I've heard, you know, I've had many extremely pleasant and extremely unpleasant experiences while meditating, and the feedback I've generally gotten from my teachers is, you know, were you mindful? Were you noting it? Were you not attached to what is inevitably a passing experience, which will arise and pass away, and to not get overly attached to these experiences or overly aversive to the negative ones, because that's the game here, just waking up to whatever's happening right now. So yeah, what you're describing sounds like somebody who's taking meditation really seriously, and these experiences are the inevitable consequence. But I do think you should go talk to somebody with even more experience than I do, and I recommend CIMC right there in Cambridge, since you said you were at Harvard. All right, that's a great question. Let's go to the second one.
Hi, Dan. Connor from Colorado here. I'd just like to get your opinion on more secular practitioners getting involved with local Buddhist communities or mindfulness clubs or Buddhist temples, just your general overall opinion for more secular, maybe not religious folk that do meditate. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate your work.
Okay, this one I am super qualified to answer because I have done what you're describing. I'm assuming you're a secular guy and you're looking around. I'm assuming here, so that's always dangerous, but I'm assuming you're a secular guy and you want to get more into meditation, and the best options appear to be a Buddhist. And my answer is there is nothing to fear. If you don't want to get swept up in a religion, I don't think you will be, because in my experience and personal and in my view, Buddhism is, and now I'm quoting the great Stephen Batchelor here, a writer who I recommend wholeheartedly, who has never come on this podcast, although we're working on it. Buddhism is not something to believe in. It's something to do. It's a set of, you know, there are plenty of things you can believe in Buddhism, including reincarnation, which we're going to talk about on this episode. But the Buddha was very specific, which was he said, you know, take or leave any of the claims I'm making. Test it out for yourself. Take what works for you. And so he was a guy skeptics can line up behind. And these Buddhist centers, you know, some of them you may like, some of them you may not. But I am of the view that Buddhism is, and I say this as somebody who is still avowedly secular. I don't believe in anything you can't prove. But Buddhism is one of the most fascinating things I have ever come across. And in the last 9 years, have spent pretty much all of my spare time reading, studying, and practicing Buddhism. And there's so much there. So, yeah, I mean, when I go into some Buddhist contexts, the bowing and the chanting and the robes, is it a little odd for me? Yeah, but is it anybody, you know, forcing me to embrace grand metaphysical theories and that I don't believe in? No. So, yeah, you may experience some discomfort, but that's just another thing to be mindful of. How's it showing up for you? What kind of thoughts? How's it showing up in your body? What kind of thoughts is it creating? What kind of emotions? That's interesting to tune in and investigate. So I wholeheartedly encourage you to experiment. It's okay if you don't like what you find in some places, but I bet you will in others. And yeah, leave us another voicemail in a couple months, and I want to hear more about your peregrinations within the world of Buddhism. But a wholehearted thumbs up there. All right. So Dzogchen Khantrol Rinpoche, again, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He has the title of Tulku, which means he's a reincarnate. He's a reincarnated Tibetan Lama. He's written many, many books, including It's Up to You, The Practice of Self-Reflection on the Buddhist Path, Light Coming Through, Natural Vitality, Uncommon Happiness. Heart Advice. He's written lots of books. The Way of Tenderness, I believe, is another book, and a lot of them are about compassion and kindness. And he has a way of talking about it that, again, makes it less ooey gooey and more practical and more sort of, you might not like this term, but I like it, sort of self-interested. What's in it for you to do this? And there's a lot in it for you to do this. And so let me shut up and have him explain. Here we go. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Dan, for having us here.
Really appreciate it. So I was reading a little bit about your biography. Very interesting. Your first teacher was your mom?
Yes, my first teacher was my mom. She was a practitioner, and she did many years of retreat before she married to my father. So, you know, as I was growing up, she's always practicing. So that kind of really gave me a huge inspiration. And also, she taught me a lot of, you know, basic stuff.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, I was under the impression that, and I'm not an expert in Tibetan culture, but I thought it was reasonably, the meditation world within the Tibetan culture was reasonably patriarchal. So is it common for women to have that amount of experience?
Where my mother is from, actually, a lot of the householders, they do receive teachings, and then they, of course, so while they're working in the household, they also practice in the breaks, you know. So I think there is a tradition. But in generally speaking, I think it is true. There is a lot more male practitioners than female practitioners. But my mother was sort of very unique in a sense that she really wanted to practice. If she didn't get that chance to practice, she was kind of really not going to be happy, so to speak. So she really asked her parents to put her into retreat. So then they did, and then she did 13 years of a retreat.
13 years?
Yeah.
Starting at what age?
I think she was around 13 or 14, something like that. And it was not in the mountains or anything. It's in the back of a family house, and they built a retreat cabin, and then the family supported two of the daughters. She did her retreat with her sister, younger sister. And so they were in retreat, yeah, in the back of the family house for closed retreat, strict retreat for 13 years.
So when you say closed retreat, strict retreat, you mean it's not like they were getting education during that time. They were actually meditating all day every day.
Yes, I think they were getting some teachings, and then they were just following the routine of we have four sessions like in a day. So early morning sessions and morning sessions and afternoon sessions and evening sessions. So they were really practicing and meditating. Yes.
Wow. And you say she was a householder, meaning she was not a nun. She was not ordained.
She wasn't a nun. She wasn't ordained. And she wanted to be. But then I think my family was kind of a big family. So they wanted her to sort of first do this retreat and then see. Then after, towards the end of her retreat, then my father came alone and then proposed her. Then her family wanted her to marry my father, so then she got married off.
And was your father a householder as well?
He was a teacher. He was a teacher, and he was a householder teacher in that region.
A meditation teacher?
Meditation teacher, and he was one of the sort of we call it Rinpoches, in that area, who had a sort of, a monastery, which also has monks as well as also lay practitioners mixed together.
So Rinpoche is a term for advanced spiritual / meditation teacher in the Tibetan world.
Yeah, Rinpoche is generally a title for reincarnate lamas, and he was one of the reincarnate lamas of that region.
And so you started meditating when you were how old?
I started to meditate. My mother put me into a retreat when I was around 10.
10 years old?
10 years old.
So separated from your family at that point?
No, actually, my brother was doing a retreat. Again, a similar situation, very close to my family home, in the back of my family home. And I was around 10, and she said, oh, this is a good time for you to really get connected with the Dharma, so you should go into retreat. So she put me into retreat. She actually asked me to do just some mantras, that's all. I wasn't, you know, taught to meditate or anything like that, but just put into retreat. Then I came out of that retreat about 3 months, and I was fantasizing about coming out and doing a lot of different things and playing, and as any child would. Then when I came out, and I did all of the things that I fantasized when I was inside the retreat while I was chanting or doing the recitations, and then it didn't. There was some kind of a feeling of emptiness, or there was some kind of feeling of void of doing all of those things. So then that's the beginning of my real interest to kind of pursue the meditation. And then I got some teachings. And then I went into retreat myself. So that was maybe when I was 13 or something like that.
So it sounds like at the age of 10, you had one of the key insights of Buddhism, which is suffering.
Yes.
That the things you thought you wanted
yes.
didn't do it for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that was really a kind of a first experience of, oh, yeah, you know, all of this playing with my friends and, you know, hanging out and, you know, wandering around, all of those things that, you know, I kind of fantasized while I was in a retreat. When I really went to do it, there was a sense of feeling like, oh, this really, you know, doesn't have so much of the kind of joy as I had when I was alone in the room doing the practice. And so it was just all made up in my mind. Mm. And while I was in the room, there was some kind of a sense of grace, you know, a sense of peace, even though I was a little bit anxious and times I was kind of getting a little bit bored. And but generally, there was a sense of peace and grace. So I really wanted that more. And I knew I wasn't, you know, taught to practice or do any kind of meditation. So if I learned the meditation or practice, it would be even better. So then I actually pursued it with receiving some more teachings. And then when I first went into retreat, it was really a great feeling of, you know, this is what I wanted to do. This is what I wanted to do all the rest of my life, kind of a feeling. Of course, I didn't stay there all the time, but there was a sense of real connection.
But that's so that second retreat, which started, I believe you said, at age 13.
Somewhere around age 13.
How long were you on retreat for?
That time then I was in retreat for about 3 months or maybe close to 4 months. And I can see from my window, looking up at the mountains, you know, there are some small villages up in the mountains, you know, from my window. And I was even wanting to go further more into the mountains and, you know, meditate up in the mountains. And there was a sense of feeling of deep joy to pursue this as a sort of lifelong path and wanting to kind of truly make it this work for myself. And I'm glad that I found those inspirations then. And then since then, I've been meditating off and on, but then seriously, from the age of, I think, maybe 20s.
So in your 20s, it was in your 20s that you started meditating seriously? You
seriously,
said?
Yes. When I was a monk for those early years, for about 10, maybe 11 years. And then I got disrobed, and then I got married. And, you know, when I first disrobed, there was kind of a very exciting time, and there was a lot of kind of possibilities and a lot of things to explore. And that's why I disrobed and I went into the kind of a world. But then after a while, again, similarly, there was kind of a, you know, void and a big life change, and there was a kind of a hit of a depression and a deep kind of like, you know, feeling of like lost. So then from there, then I kind of seriously sort of pursued meditation practice. I went up into a mountain and I stayed up there for about a year and pursuing kind of a meditation.
How'd your wife feel about that?
No, that time, actually, we haven't met. This is just right, you know, before I met.
I see. After disrobing, but before you met your wife.
Before I met my wife, yeah. So then from there, then, of course, you know, we got married, and then, you know, we had a child, then we moved here. Then I was asked to teach in Naropa Institute, Naropa University, in the graduate programs. So then I was teaching. So then I, you know, pursued it seriously, you know, just as I was responsible to teach to others.
You described your father as
Rinpoche,
a reincarnation.
Reincarnation, yes.
Of and but you have the title as well.
Yes, I was also recognized at the age of I think 10. I was recognized as a reincarnate of a friend of my father's who actually passed away just right before he left Tibet. And so then I was enthroned into my father's monastery in India, and then I grew up there. And so since then I have this title of
Tulku. T-U-L-K-U, Tulku,
yeah.
Which is the title, another word for a reincarnated lama.
Yeah, Tulku generally means a reincarnated lamas. And Rinpoche means just an honorific name for Tukus, just meaning precious one or something like that.
So how do you talk about reincarnation to a skeptical Western person like me? Because I consider myself to be a Buddhist, but I've seen no evidence for reincarnation. So how am I supposed to grapple with this?
Yeah, I think, there's no... not found an evidence of reincarnation, but there's also not found no evidence of reincarnations as well, too.
You mean so, there's no evidence against it?
No evidence against it. So it's a kind of a belief of what you take on as a mind. You know, if you take on mind as in a consciousness that is like momentary, and it is a stream of momentarily rising and dissolving, and that, you know, continuum of the moments till the end, then... when the body goes into the distractions, the separation between the body and the mind happens, but the mind continues as into the kind of intermediate state. And so there's no reasons for or continuation of the moment after the last moment of this life. And the next one to arise. So, I mean, even as a body, in the atomic level, the continuations of the atom continues. It doesn't just evaporates and becomes non-existent. It continues. So it's like that the stream of consciousness also continues. And then when it continues in the... into the kind of intermediate state, it is not going to have this body, but it's going to have something similar to this body, like what we have in the dream. You know, we have something similar to this body in the dream that the consciousness sort of is attached to, or consciousness sort of like perceives and carries on. Something like that in the bardo or the intermediate state. You continue for maximum up to 49 days. In the 49 days, then whatever the sort of like a karma or whatever the sort of next birth is to be, then you have a sort of visions of that. And there's a lot of beings who are searching for birth. So then you take a birth. And in the birth, there's the kind of the birth of the womb, and then there's the birth from the eggs, then there's the moisture birth, and then there's the birth of sort of like a spontaneously popping up into a realm. So there's different types of birth. So the life then in that way circles. That's kind of the belief. But of course, you know, in order for anyone to really truly take this seriously and believe, there has to be some kind of enough faith in the kind of, you know, not just in the evidence, but there has to be some kind of a connection and a faith in the kind of spiritual path in the Dharma, and as well as also to sort of like see this as a long sort of like a term and the benefit of the long term, not just immediately what it does for you, but something that it will help you in the long run to evolve yourself and evolve your consciousness into a sort of higher state and higher and a much more of an enlightened state.
But in the view of the Tibetan tradition, would I be considered a bad Buddhist with insufficient faith?
No, I don't think there is a bad Buddhist. I think it's just like, whether it is through the intellect that you get to have in a sort of faith, or whether over the time your connection grows into the spiritual path, that your then faith kind of grows. Or, you know, you just have the faith. I think, people come different ways, and it's not really like you should have and you must have or anything like that. It's just more like where you are and see what actually to have the faith in the rebirth and the kind of like a bigger vision of oneself evolving over the time. How does that sort of like support you and your spiritual path, and how does that support your kind of like overall psychological and emotional well-being, you know, to have some kind of like hope for the future rather than just everything extinct, being extinct or finished or everything sort of like going to a blank here. So in my view, in just my personal experience as well as people who, you know, I've talked to, there seems like just with a positive kind of like a hope, there's a much less fear and much less sort of like attachments to this. Because however we believe, you know, there isn't our next life or life after this, you know, we're going to be attached to this body. And it seems like the attachment to this body or this life becomes a little bit more sort of solidified. There's nothing to hope for in the future, or nothing to kind of like vision to go after this life. So with the rebirth and with the kind of idea of the rebirth, there's a sense of like a continuation or something to look forward and something to kind of, you know, what you do here to reap a fruit in the next life. And then particularly with the sort of a consciousness, like if you explore the consciousness essence, as you have meditated, you would know this. There comes a time where actually, you know, you are in a kind of a state where actually you're not fabricating, but you are present. And then there's really a wakefulness, you know. And that present and the wakefulness has no sort of like a rising or dwelling or ceasing. So that essence, you know, is going to be very difficult to be annihilated or destroyed, or what is there to be even in the first place destroyed. You know, like with the physical thing, there's something to be destroyed, but with that, there's nothing to be destroyed.
So you're talking now about one of the great mysteries, in my view, kind of the great mystery of consciousness.
Yes.
Ooh, how are the lights on in here?
Yeah.
In my head, but not even in my, we don't even know if the consciousness is in the head, it could be in your knee.
Yeah.
And in meditation, for a low level meditator such as myself, even people like me, you can get a sense of who's the one knowing all of this. Yeah. who's feeling the breath, who's hearing sounds and all of this stuff.
Yes.
And so you're saying that consciousness, which is this mysterious way.
Yes.
You can't imagine it being destroyed.
Destroyed. Yeah, that, you know, like there's a two types of consciousness. There's a types of consciousness that rises and falls and that is sort of, you know, aware of objects. And then there's a consciousness that is not really necessarily aware of an object and that also doesn't rise and fall. And it's all omniscient and present. And it's there, you know, unfabricated. And you feel that and you experience that. And in there's no really sort of duality like a me or them or I or he or she, you know. And that, you know, is the source of all other consciousness that evolves, you know. Without that, there's no really any other consciousness of like a thought process or the emotions or the eye consciousness or the sensory consciousness. Any of the consciousness could not have a base to arise. But because of that, primordial consciousness is being there, then all the other consciousness, you know, gets sort of has the base to rise and fall, you know. So, of course, other consciousness are going to be impermanent and they're going to be shaped and conditioned by the conditions, like organs and objects. But the primordial consciousness is not shaped in
primordial consciousness.
Primordial
right.
consciousness.
So we may have temporary hearing, temporary seeing, temporary yes. tasting. Those are all the temporary arisings of consciousness, but they all play out against what you're calling primordial consciousness, yes. which is this mysterious knowing that's happening in the background.
Exactly. Exactly. And that, since that's there, then since that sort of like unchangingly continues, so then all of the other consciousness and the life-based consciousness, you know, is going to be also there with these sort of different conditions. Of course, it's not going to be the same conditions as here. Like in the dreams, we don't have the same conditions as what we have in the awakening. But there is a conditions to see and hear, things like that. So there is going to be that kind of continuations of life and the consciousness that actually experiences the life in the world.
Well, let me ask you one last obnoxious question about reincarnation before we get back to your story. Don't you think it's convenient that your dad's buddy passes away and it turns out that his son is the guy who's the reincarnate?
Well, I think if there's some advantage that I could actually have, then it most probably could be, perceived that way. Since being a reincarnate is a lot of shouldering of responsibilities and work, and also a lot of, sense of kind of duty to sort of serve, I think it's maybe perhaps, even if it is, it is to sort of really help the community, and it's to help the culture, and it's to help the the continuation of the Dharma in the world. So I take it with a sort of sense of honor, and not I feel like I'm a reincarnate. No one most probably feels that way, but there's a sense of honor that we feel being kind of entrusted this responsibility with the name,
because it takes on it's I was indicating that I was in my role as skeptical journalist, I was badgering you about whether this was some sort of spiritual nepotism, but you're basically saying that this is actually an important ceremonial role in the community, and asking somebody to take on the role of a tilku is a responsibility.
Look at this way, as a Tibetan, we lost our country, we had to exile, and we landed in India with really nothing in 1959 and the early 60s. We were just really in a very, very bad condition. Now the Tibetan community in India is thriving and it's doing well. Of course, still we have a lot of issues and a lot of things to be done to make progress in the society, in the community, and the culture and the tradition. But we have been able to preserve the culture and the religion and the dharma and the path and the practice of meditation, and so as also all of the kind of the language and so on and so forth. It has to be done by somebody. It has to be done in a system. One of the ways to do that was the kind of entrusting recognizing tukus and entrusting responsibilities to tukus to kind of like do that. And there are, of course, good tukus and there are bad tukus. But most of the tukus really have tried their best. You know, of course, we are all human beings. We have failures. But most of the tukus have done, and because of the works of the, not just only tukus, but the Tibetans and the Tibetans in this way, carrying forward into the kind of like a new world, so to speak, I think we have really managed to sort of like really not completely lost our tradition and culture and the dharma and the way of life, and so as also the kind of whole of our sort of like a belief systems, you know. So I think in that way there is some real great value.
Well, you've really gone far afield with the teachings. I mean, you've taken it far and wide. So tell me about why you came to the United States and what a big change, because you were in northern India?
Yes.
I was Dharamsala?
Nearby Dharamsala, nearby Dharamsala, place called Bir, where there's a Tibetan refugee community, and I was born and grew up there. So, you know, that's where I was, very close, about 2 hours from Dharamsala. Then I came to America because, you know, I got married to my wife, and then we had a son, and then I had to kind of make a living, and, you know, she was from here. So
she was American.
She's American, yeah. So then her parents were living in Los Angeles, so they invited us to come and stay with them, so we came and stayed with them. And then, of course, you know, they wanted to, you know, move to Santa Fe, and then we had to also move to somewhere. So then at that time I was offered a job in Naropa to teach Buddhism, and then I moved to Boulder, and then there, you know, some of my initial first students came and asked to be a student, and then we formed a small sangha, and then we started from there, very fresh and just organically. It wasn't like a plan. It was just through the kind of like events of life that brought me here and made me into sort of who I am.
So there are a million other questions that I can ask about your life, and we'll get back to it. But let's talk a little bit. You've written a number of books, and you've got a new one.
Yeah.
The paperback is, I think by the time we record this, we'll probably just have, by the time we release this, the paperback will be newly released. It's called Training in Tenderness.
Training and tenderness, yes.
Buddhist teachings on, so how do I pronounce that?
Sewa.
Sewa, yeah. The radical openness of heart that can change the world. Let's talk this through. So what do you mean when you say tenderness?
Tenderness. Like, for example, I was just thinking last night how to sort of communicate this. Recently, I was in India, and in Varanasi, I was in the Ganges. And then in the evening, there's lots of people, like thousands of people, come to sort of witness this sort of ceremony that they do every evening. So I was coming back, the thousands of people are coming back. And then, you know, I was sitting next to a shop, and then there's a little infant baby, you know, just size of like a baby. Melon, you know, size of melon, maybe 5 pounds, on the ground, while all these people, you know, are leaving. And when everybody sees that, there's a sort of like once a heart kind of leaping out, you know, everybody stops, and everybody sort of like, you know, feels this sort of like tenderness, you know. Why? Because we all have this, you know, tenderness, you know, when we see another life or another life which seems so kind of like, you know, vulnerable and which needs the conditions of happiness and which lacks the sort of like conditions of the happiness and which seems like in such a kind of like a dry situation and a painful situation, you know. Of course, the conceptual mind is one thing, but the kind of a heart leaping out from your chest and then feeling something that at that moment, that is the seva, you know, and we all have that. Of course, we can shut it down and we can sort of like, you know, ignore it and do a lot with it, but I think we all have that. And this kind of like a feeling of just to towards all living beings, or particularly towards, you know, another human beings, if we can sort of, instead of like a contracting our heart, if we can keep our heart open and then let that sort of a tender feeling, you know, warm, tender feeling arise, you know, on the basis of acknowledging that they are living beings just as myself, and they're going through the same things as, you know, hopes for the happiness and joy and conditions of the happiness to be plentiful, or whatever is needed to be in their lives, just as I'm kind of like hoping that, and I'm wishing that I have that needs, you know. And then sort of really making the wish not exclusively for yourself, but wish for all of the humanity to sort of, you know, get that happiness and get that kind of a joy in the conditions, you know. That sort of like makes your, you know, heart open and keeps your heart kind of like warm. And then also it starts to sort of like, you know, make a connection with others. And then others starts to sort of like having a response with response to that, and then there's a sense of real kind of a bond that develops, you know. So that's ever in essence.
Do you not think there are people who are psychopaths or sociopaths or borderline personalities who are actually incapable of tsewa, or even people who are the victims of external circumstances that hardened them so much, you know, childhood abuse or, I don't know, that put them in a situation where their tsewa is hard to access, if not infinitesimally small?
I think, you know, definitely there are sociopaths, and there are, you know, people who are disturbed and people who have really hardened, you know. But, you know, tsewa is not, you know, based on object of just only towards others. Tsewa is also based on object of yourself, you know, object of yourself. So, you know, even though they may have not, you know, tsewa for others or explicitly expressed that tsewa for others, there is that kind of tenderness towards yourself and tenderness towards care for your own. So if, you know, there isn't a tenderness for yourself and care for yourself, then we are talking about not whether somebody has the potential of tsewa or not. We are talking about the conditions, you know, conditions being sort of in those people, they are lacking to express that tsewa towards others. You know, now if they get to see the sort of a meaning and the reasons and the value and sort of a sense of like how this can actually sort of help them to increase, to express the tseva towards not just for themselves, but to others, and expressing the tseva towards others, especially to whom they are related, whom they are close, who are in their environment, how it's a win-win situation, then I think, you know, that sort of the wisdom can guide them to increase the tseva and open the heart. So I really feel like a potential of the tseva is in everyone.
So, but given that we live in a world where there are many people who have trouble accessing their innate capacity for kindness, generosity, tenderness, whatever word you want to use, does that put those of us who are interested in developing our capacities in this area at some risk? In other words, if the more... I hear this a lot. People say to me, the more I'm actually working on a book about kindness right now, and the rap on the common critique of kindness is, well, if I the more kind I get, the more I'm going to get pushed around by jerks.
No, it's actually not about, you know, it's not about feeling obliged to feel tseva and feeling obliged to sort of be kind because of the tseva, and also go out of your realm and out of your boundaries to, you know, jeopardize yourself. You know, it has to accompany with the intelligence and the critical thinking, as well as how this really is going to sort of play out and how this is going to sort of like be helpful to oneself and others, and how, you know, doing something just based on kind of this being good, and therefore it should be sort of unlimited, and therefore you should sort of go all the way to kind of force yourself. That's a, you know, a wrong view, and that's not an sort of like a, you know, gradual path. There has to be a gradual of accompanying your sort of opening of heart and that seva increasing with your intelligence and with your sort of critical thinking and with the sense of knowing what works and what doesn't work. So it has to be married with the intelligence, you know, the emotion of the opening of heart, emotion of flowing of seva, emotion of kindness being felt and intended to feel more for others, has to also be, you know, guided with the wisdom. So the marriage of, you know, in critical intelligence with the, you know, emotions together, then I don't see, you know, even when you cannot do something and when you see, you know, doing something that will turn out being not helpful, you know, there has to be also, you know, a sense of a kind of a, not, you know, turning against the seva, but sort of like knowing one's own limit and stopping where it needs to be stopped, and also not sort of like expressing one's seva with a sort of a kindness that is sort of going to turn into a sour and have a bad sort of comeback.
So there's an expression I like from, I believe this expression exists in the Tibetan tradition of idiot compassion.
Idiot compassion, yeah. It could, you know, turn into idiot compassion, you know, if one doesn't use one's sort of critical intelligence along with the sort of intelligence of the emotions.
So how do we go about developing this? So you make the case that that this tenderness is innate in all of us, and that the smart ones will see, or the wise people will see, actually it's the source of happiness that you can, yes, if you develop. And the Dalai Lama talks about this too. He calls, talks about wise selfishness. Mm-hmm. The wise selfish person realizes that compassion, kindness, generosity, these are actually what makes a good life. Yeah. And you will develop this concern for others because it redounds to your benefit moment to moment where life is lived. Mm-hmm. So how do we develop this capacity in your view?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a source of happiness, but it is a state of happiness in itself.
Mm-hmm.
That is also very important to know. So I think, first of all, I think there has to be an interest, you know, there has to be a sort of an intention to want to have a seva, you know. There has to be, with anything, some intention, and there has to be some interest so that it's not like a force onto you or anything like that, you know. Now, generally speaking, you know, I think the sense of like if anyone to you is a warm, open, and non-threatening, but really there to kind of like, you know, connect with you, we all appreciate that. So what you appreciate from others, you have to sort of, you know that others appreciate that. So with that base, then you want to have some kind of an interest or some kind of a connection to sort of like develop yourself in that way. So then the way to do it is really sort of is, you know, basically, you know, coming in touch with your own mind, you know, kind of observing where your state of mind is, and then acknowledging that there's a lot of, you know, aspirations in your mind, you know. Yeah. Making a connection with your mind, taking the time to realize that there's a lot of aspirations in your mind, and that there's a lot of, you know, hopes in your mind, and there's a lot of kind of a sense of a drive to meet the conditions and have the conditions to fulfill this kind of an aspirations or this kind of hopes in your mind. Getting in touch with all of those things about yourself first is the foremost important, you know. Coming to know yourself rather than sort of like automatically working and just always sort of like rush and always focus outwardly and kind of like going. There has to be a turning your mind inwardly to observe one's state. So when you see that, and then there's also a lot of, you know, fears, and there's a lot of, you know, anxieties, and there's a lot of a sense of, you know, kind of a vulnerabilities inside of you. So then once you get in touch with that, then knowing, you know, look at anyone in this world, you know, who doesn't have that? Everyone has that, just like you. Outside, we may look different, we may act different, we may are in a different places, and we may have seemingly a different conditions. But inside, everyone is identical, you know. And to be able to see that in a real way, that there's no really a differences between oneself and others, all those differences is just a facade differences. That in essence, there's no differences, you know, as who we are as a living being. And getting to, when you get to that place with some kind of conviction, then it's easier to sort of develop that tenderness towards others, you know, openness towards others, warm feeling towards others, as you have that. And there's nothing you lose. You actually, you know, including others makes you yourself grow, and the happiness grow, and so it's also a source of happiness grow, you know. In there, when you realize, if you actually continuously sort of hold on to the self and just the aspiration of the self, and the hopes of the self and the vulnerability of the self and trying to kind of like put yourself in a box, you see how it's painful. It actually creates some kind of like a more anxiety.
The black hole of self-obsession.
Black hole of self-obsession. So in that way then, you know, trying to kind of increase that seva for all living beings. And then as a way to sustain yourself in that state of the seva or the openness, and then the way to connect with them is then making aspirations on behalf of others. You don't know all the aspirations of others, but it is an aspiration of happiness and joy, and conditions of happiness and joy to be increased in their life. So making prayers in that direction sort of like sustains you in that. And then doing that consciously, so that you are sort of like in touch with yourself in your own internal life, and then sort of like acknowledging, and then making that into a ground for one's connection with others and increasing the openness and the warm feelings and, you know, warm thoughts and prayers being offered on behalf of others. Kind of like, you know, makes you in that 5-10 minutes of a time buoyant, you know, from makes you come out of your own locked in sub-absorption a lot of the times and anxiety. And then it makes you buoyant. So
you're talking about a 5-10 minute practice, a formal meditation practice?
Formal meditation, or just getting in touch with yourself and kind of in a formal meditation practice, you know, that would be, I think, very suggestible.
You use the term prayer.
Prayer is like, you know, may all sentient beings be happy and have the cause and conditions of happiness, something like that, being sort of like a chanted, you know, in your head over and over. And the doing that sort of like sustains you in that open state of mind rather than sort of drift away back into the sort
of. So 5 to 10 minutes, you can put yourself in a reasonably quiet space or put some headphones on and actually say to yourself the words, may all sentient beings have the,
happiness and the cause and conditions of happiness. May all sentient beings or may all living beings have, happiness and the cause and conditions of happiness. You know,
and just repeating that to yourself, actually, you're building the muscle of sewa, tenderness,
that's right.
Compassion.
That's right.
Friendliness. There are lots of words for this. It's interesting. You know, I feel like there are.
But the first, I think,
Go ahead.
I think what I wanted to say is getting in touch with yourself, where you are, what your internal life is, and what's going on with your own self, rather than sort of like being in this automatic mode and going. You know, trying to achieve. But what you're trying to achieve, why you're trying to achieve, what is the kind of emotions behind, what is the kind of reasons behind, what are you feeling, you know, what are your take-ons, not being kind of examined. It's just sort of like, you know, just being driven, you know, is a really a way to kind of, first that has to be kind of address and turn one's mind inwardly to kind of get in touch with
as part of the formal practice or as something you do
just in the park, you know, just in the quiet space, and just when you're falling asleep and when you're, you know, not able to fall asleep and you have some space of time to kind of think, you know, and reflect, you know.
And the reflection again is sort of What do I want? Who am I? Where am I going?
Who am I? Where am I going? Why am I going there? What do I aspire? You know, why do I aspire that? You know, what do I feel? You know, if I'm so fixed on something, why am I fixated on this? You know, this kind of a question, so asking to yourself, and then sort of not having an immediate answer, smart answer, but just really genuinely discovering, you know, where you are and what your intelligence tells you.
I always feel like if you follow this kind of self-inquiry to its logical extent, if you ask yourself, what do I really want? Mm-hmm. The initial answers may be quite worldly. Yeah. If I was doing it for myself, I want my company to succeed. I want to get as many promotions as I possibly can get at ABC News. I want my books to sell a lot. Okay, but what does that really mean at the level of the mind?
Yes,
that's right. And do you ultimately get down to just positive mental states?
Yeah.
That's what we want.
That's right.
And if you could
get the positive mental state from sort of really just kind of like opening up your heart and feeling that seva and the connection towards the humanity and then making a sort of aspirations on behalf of the humanity, then all of those could be bypassed. I mean, though they have some values and they can actually offer a lot to you, but you don't feel so desperate.
For the worldly things. For just like when you were 10 years old, stuck on that meditation retreat and you wanted to be playing with your buddies, and you got out there and you started doing, and you realized, okay, it's not as good as I thought it was going to be.
There are
roots that frustratingly for somebody who's as kind of sarcastic and skeptical and Western as I am, often they're described with words that can be a little triggering for anti-sentimentalists such as myself. So the roots to happiness that actually are a little bit more sustainable and more successful usually often are described with words like tenderness, kindness, generosity, words that, you know, somebody who grows up in this culture, we hear them in after-school specials and lectures from our parents.
And especially, you know, I mean, if you are a householder, if you have a family and you have, offsprings, you know, you're doing a lot of this, you know, just not for yourself if, mm-hmm. you know, you ask people. You're doing this for your family, you know. You're doing this for the, you know, happiness of the family and for the people who you love, you know. But there's other ways to sort of love them, other ways to care for them, other ways to sort of connect with them, other ways to contribute to their life and happiness, you know, that you could share in the moment rather than sort of like ignoring the moment, ignoring the situation, ignoring the kind of like a possibility of what is within in your range and then trying to sort of like, fixate it on something else outside, you know. That is really the kind of the downfall of the modernizations, you know.
I have the sense that just as some of us are innately better at basketball, some of us are innately better at kindness and compassion. So, for example, I have a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. He has this amazing nanny mm-hmm. who everybody tells us all the time, but people in our apartment building will stop us in the elevator. Just when it's my wife and I alone, people will say, you know, I watch your nanny sometimes. She's so great. She just loves your kids so much. And the other children in my son's class run to sit in his nanny's lap. And I asked her once, why do they do that? And she said, well, they know where their love is. And I look at her and I think she's an amazing human. No other kids aren't rushing to sit in my lap. I'm not saying I'm, you know, Pol Pot or the mass murderer or something like that, but I mean, I don't ooze the kind of compassion and caring and kindness that she does. Do you agree that there are, you know, I'm seriously interested in developing my capacity for tsewa, but don't you think we all approach this endeavor at different levels?
I think there's a lot of conditions that we are actually born with, you know, and that shapes us, and particularly how we grow up and what kind of a family we grew up in, how much of a warmth and openness and a kind of tenderness there is. You know, it's sort of like, gives us a model how to be. And in that way, I think, you know, we maybe come out seemingly different. But I think if somebody is interested, you know, somebody who's, you know, initially, you know, without the sort of like interest and without the training or without the kind of, really kind of sitting with one's own kind of a mind, it could be very angry and very sort of short-tempered and very kind of like a fast reactor, you know, to sort of like repel anybody who comes close. But slowly, slowly in training in the mind and training in this kind of like a openness and a tenderness and, you know, kind of being there, you know, rather than sort of doing something, being there as in a no threat, no harm, you know, right? Being there, open, right? And then whatever ways that you could actually in a way be and help, you know, being sort of available or just willing to stretch yourself, that I think can really be developed. That can be developed and that changes your relation. A relationship is not permanent at all in that way, you know. And so I think somebody can really, from not like that, get there, you know, because there is that sort of like interest and there is that sort of intention and there is that sort of like a progressively kind of a transforming yourself, you know, inside. Of course, one might retract with some fears or some kind of anxieties and some, you know, times, you know, feeling of, you know, maybe perhaps, you know, a distrust of oneself or what one is doing. But then, you know, over the time, as you also work with them and get through them, then I think, you know, you could really sort of have a change of, you know, a change of your relations with the world and others, I really do believe. I mean, to what extent, but to some extent, that's for sure.
Well, I'm glad you talked about the potential we all have, even if we're embarked in this training, to regress.
Yeah.
You know, there are, I should just say for the clarification of listeners, there are many, many training techniques within the Buddhism's, within the various schools of Buddhism, and also many of these techniques have also been secularized and can be taught to anybody for training compassion. And you're from the Tibetan school. There are many techniques aside from just repeating the phrase that we uttered before about may all sentient beings have happiness and the sources of happiness. There are lots of ways to train in compassion. And I'm from the Theravada school. We have our own ways of doing it. And again, there are secular ways to do it as well. That being said, I wonder how convinced you are that it really works. Because, for example, I look at what's happening in Burma right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, Buddhist monks who are not from your part of Buddhism, but there are Buddhist monks, Theravada Buddhist monks, and so not Tibetan Buddhist monks, in Burma who are involved in what is, by many descriptions, a genocide of Muslims in Burma, now known as Myanmar. So I look at that and I'm saying, all right, these are Buddhist monks. These are people who I guess have done some meditation, some training. Where's their sewa right now?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what makes the training, first of all, I think, work is based on the mind, being reflective, you know, and having this sort of a quality of being reflective. Now, if you actually get in touch with your own mind and get in touch with your own feelings and get in touch with your own aspirations and get in touch with your own kind of happiness and what sort of like makes you happy and what sort of contributes your life to sort of be happier and have a sort of more kind of a well-being from inside, you know, it's going to be, you know, not contracting your heart, not within an anger, not within a grudge, not within a sense of really kind of a wanting to kind of eliminate what is obstacle, so to speak, outside for you. It is going to be with a more sort of like open heart, more sort of tender feelings and kind thoughts and compassionate thoughts and more tolerance and more sense of like a really willing to kind of like extend yourself in your limit to others. That's just given fact, right? Given fact. And the mind coming to realizations of those, you know, ultimately have to transform you, you know. Not because you're outwardly being a Buddhist or you're outwardly looking like you are meditator or outwardly you are sort of, in kind of a position to, teach or anything like that. It has to be that mind coming to sort of self-realizations, you know. And in this way, then I really do feel, we all get passionate and we all get sort of like caught up in our own sort of like beliefs, and we all get into sort of our own kind of sense of like self-protectiveness and thinking that, what we are doing is sort of, we are doing it for the reasons we are doing it, and those reasons are valid. You know, so what's happening in the, I think, in the Burma, Myanmar, right now, it's a totally against the Buddhism, in that way, but most probably, in this way, I think, they're doing it, and I think what they're doing is not really sort of reflection of the insight meditation, it's not a reflection of progressive teachings of the Buddhas to sort of like, know yourself and know your better qualities, and what is the sort of like a source of genuine kind of like a happiness or enlightenment. This is some bizarre thing.
So what about you? You're married. Marriage is can be tricky.
Very challenging.
Yeah, say that again.
Very challenging.
Yes, it can be challenging. And you have a son.
His son, yeah.
He's, how old is he now?
He's 30. He's,
okay. Yeah. So he's not in diapers. I hope not. Mm. So you've been through the diaper stage. You've been through adolescence. So how did you have moments that where your capacity for tsewa was put to the test?
Oh yeah, always. I mean, you would say capacity of the tsewa put to the test is an everyday challenge, right? It's not like you achieve a state and then you stay there and it doesn't get at all shaken. But it's your sort of like emphasis is what really is meaningful to you, what is important to you, what sort of like is something that you could hold on to kind of like in the kind of a good times and bad times, in the both times, And even you are put into a test and challenge, and sometimes, you just as we are all humans and just as we all have our own self and self-protection, and then also sort of we have a tendency to sort of project threat, and then we have aggression towards that, and then we get sort of like all worked up in the confusions, and then we lose our balance. That happens a lot. But, there's a way to come back to the way you want to be, and then working through those emotions. And even though some of those things have become sort of like a little bit out of a hand and sort of have created a little bit of chaos in your life, there's also, like regrets, remorse, and then, feeling kind of apologetic, and then confessing. All of this is a part of an increasing of the seva, and, it is sort of like, to sort of help the seva to not be lost in the ultimate level or have that kind of somehow become not important to you.
You've done a great job with this interview. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you?
No, you asked wonderful questions. Thank you so much for all those questions. I hope that this seva, my hope and intention and aspiration and prayers is that it sort of really warms up all the household in United States as well as also in the world and everywhere, way it reaches, so that there's a real much more palpable of happiness and joy in, hands without sort of like having to go into the sort of material world within some kind of like, of course, improvement needs to be there, but what's already available in their lives.
I want to give you a chance before we go to tell people if they want to learn more about you, work, how can they find that information?
I think my name is Kongtrul Rinpoche, and we have an organization that is named after my teacher, Mangala Shri Bhuti. And I think
is there a website? Do you know the website off the
there
off
is
the
a
top
website, but I don't know how to kind of tell you the website.
We'll put it in we'll put it in the show notes, folks. And I also want to point out that you've written a bunch of books. So your newest book is Training in Tenderness, but you also wrote a book called It's Up to You: The Practice of Self-Reflection on the Buddhist Path. Light Comes Through: Buddhist Teachings on Awakening to Our Natural Intelligence, and Uncommon Happiness: The Path of the Compassionate Warrior. Oh, also, The Intelligent Heart, A Guide to the Compassionate Life. So you're prolific.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to spend this time with you, Dan, and really please carry on your outreach, you know, to the larger world as you are, you know, put in this position with such a good fortune of your karma to really do some good work. And I really appreciate all your work that you have done already.
Thank you. Next time I see you, I will be a shining beacon of sewa.
Wonderful.
I promise.
Wonderful. I can see you have a lot of sewa in you.
Yeah. Hey, don't trust your first impression. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank
really
you
fun.
Very much.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier Podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produce this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.